Kennst du schon die Bodyguard Boxspringmatratze von bett1.de? 28 cm Komfort, 100% Vollschaum, ganz ohne Metallfedern. Zwei Liegehärten in einer Matratze. Einfach wenden und deine Lieblingsseite wählen. Und das Beste? Du kannst 100 Nächte lang Probeschlafen. Egal ob ausschlafen, Serien gucken oder krümeln im Bett. Und wenn sie dir nicht gefällt, holen wir sie kostenlos wieder ab. Die Bodyguard Boxspringmatratze von bett1.de gibt es bereits ab 333 Euro. Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I'm broadcasting awkwardly from a hotel in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Awkwardly because the main room of this room was too bouncy. I'm a little sensitive to the bounce, the sound bounce. It's a little better in here, so I'm propped up on a chair in front of a dresser in the bedroom of this suite talking to you. You all right? Today on the show, I talked to Nicole Holofcener. She's a writer-director of films like Walking and Talking, Friends with Money, Lovely and Amazing, Enough Said. She also wrote the screenplay for Can You Ever Forgive Me with Melissa McCarthy and co-wrote The Last Duel with Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. She also directed TV shows like Parks and Rec, Inside Amy Schumer, One Mississippi, and Orange is the New Black. My late girlfriend, Lynn Shelton, was a big fan of Nicole Holofcener. Always talked about her movies. I watched many of her movies. I actually had a brief conversation with her about perhaps bringing to life a script that Lynn and I had been writing for years, but I never really followed through with that. I don't know really what to do with that. There's a pain to it. There's something special about it remaining the thing that we did and not necessarily realizing it without her. So I will talk to her shortly. I think I must have come through here at some trek across the country, because I think this road, this interstate, turns into I-40 at some point, which cuts right into New Mexico. I must have drove across Oklahoma through the top of Texas on into New Mexico at some point, because oddly, I do remember Oral Roberts University just sitting out there in the middle of what seems like a plains area. I mean, there are other buildings. There's downtown Tulsa, but there's this massive tower that I believe belonged to Oral Roberts University. I don't know if it's still called Oral Roberts University, but there's these series of towers that I remembered seeing and I remembered looking up. So I must have made the trek, and I've been here for a day, and it's been kind of eventful, I guess, but everything's an event when you're in a new place. I arrived, got the car from the airport, and we drove by massive protests out in front of City Hall here in Oklahoma, because I believe the governor, as of the day before yesterday, enacted some sort of draconian shit show anti-abortion legislation in preparation for the great pulling of the rug out from under all the women of this country that is poised to happen as fascism creeps in. It's really all we should be talking about, and the environment. But it doesn't seem to be the broader cultural discussion. It's more of a Kardashian thing, or, you know, what's going on in the world of fiction. I took a lift yesterday out to I need to go to Whole Foods, stock up on some stuff, because I immediately got it into my head that everything's got to change. Everything's got to change. If I'm going to be on the road, I can't just eat like nothing matters. I've got to take care of myself. I've been in and out of that, taking care of myself on the road, not taking care of myself. But I really had shifted into, as of yesterday, I was like, I'm going to do it. So I took a car out to a Whole Foods that was, it must have been a half hour away. And it was fine. But the ride out there, the guy who drove me was a nice guy, you know, Oklahoma dude. And, you know, you get to talking. I got to talking. He seemed real nice. He's telling me a little bit about the city. We discussed as we were driving that Oral Roberts University, which is apparently the tower, he told me, is supposed to be the height of Noah's Ark. And he says, I know the Bible pretty well, and I think that's about right. And I'm like, that seems big. And he said, yeah, it took 120 years to build that. And I said, well, that must have been a few generations. He's like, no, you know, they lived longer then. I'm like, okay. Well, then the other question is, how do you keep employment? So, yeah, how do you employ people for that long over an arc of 120 years to keep people in the job? I'm just assuming that was tricky. And he laughed at that, which maybe always, when I get laughs from people that are truly believers at things that are just about logic, it makes me believe that they kind of know that it's kind of bullshit. But I don't know. There's no reason to push it, but I'm always happy when I get the laugh from the deep believers, because it was logical and it made sense in modern terms that that's fucking ridiculous. But nonetheless, I brought up the fact that they built an ark, I think in Kentucky somewhere at the Creation Museum, wherever that is. He said, yeah, he'd heard about that. But we were just talking. It was a varied conversation. And we talked a lot about barbecue, sort of got into, I asked how everybody fared here with the pandemic and if things were bouncing back. And he said, well, I don't know. We didn't really, there wasn't that big of a shift because we didn't stop. And then as time, you know, as the conversation went on, you know, he said he might have had it a month or so ago, the new one, but, you know, he wasn't sure that, you know, he hadn't been vaxxed. And that, you know, the people he worked with all during the pandemic, no one got it and no one was wearing masks until the mandate. But there was no tone of anger or anything. There was just a matter of factness to it. And this guy seemed like a reasonably nice guy. And then, you know, we got to talking, you know, about, you know, just how I kind of said, well, it looks like, you know, we're going to be dealing with this stuff. And then just matter of fact, we brought up a meeting that took place with the CDC, the WHO, and the global leaders in Wuhan about pandemic management, you know, within, you know, weeks of the pandemic starting, suggesting that, you know, it was some sort of conspiracy, that they couldn't possibly have been meeting just to discuss the possibility of something that was bound to happen. But okay, it was, and I said to him, I said, well, you know, it seems that, you know, as viral strains, bacterial strains become more antibiotic resistant, that, you know, these things are going to happen, that these diseases, these viruses and bacteria are going to evolve and adapt, not unlike any other organism, and they're going to get worse and more persistent. And he goes, exactly, you know, like that MRSA and like, you know, a couple other things we talked about. But again, the logic was there, but not applied to the possibility that the pandemic was just a pandemic and not some sort of global conspiracy meant to do what, I'm not sure, kill everybody. But then we talked about food some more. And it was one of those things that you come away from where you're like, well, that guy was a nice guy. And it was actually, I hadn't had a conversation with a guy that has profoundly different beliefs than I do about everything. But, you know, we kind of met somewhere around, you know, brisket and chicken. But it didn't feel volatile. And I don't think any progress was made. But he was an okay human with a pretty wrong-minded way of looking at the world. Okay, so I'm here shooting an episode of Reservation Dogs, which I'm thrilled about. And last night I went out with Sterling Harjo, the producer and creator, and Bobby Wilson, the guy who wrote my episode, and Britt Hensel. And we went to a beautiful little restaurant called Lowood here in Tulsa. It was great. So that's what I'm here doing. I'm going to shoot some Reservation Dogs. And it was so fucked up, man. I'm talking to Sterling, and he told me, and I knew this, you know, that Sam Kennison's grave is here, and I owe Kennison something. You know, there's possibility for full closure, because like many of you don't know the story. And if I just tell you this, it's going to sound weird and out of context without you knowing the story. But, you know, when I was a younger person and I was a doorman at the Comedy Store, you know, I had a falling out with Kennison, you know, after spending hours and hours, you know, hanging out with him, doing his coke and listening to him ramble on about the universe. But I had a big falling out with him, and it started with him pissing on my bed because I let a Satanist hang out in there so Sam wouldn't kick his ass. Long story. So Sam wouldn't kick his ass. But nonetheless, he peed on my bed, and I never slept in it again since, and I shortly left Los Angeles in a fury of cocaine psychosis. Now, The point is that I always sort of made a promise to myself that I would piss on Kennison's grave to get closure. I've since sort of altered that fantasy because I've let it go and I've processed it. But Sterling brought it up to me last night that Kennison's grave is here. And I'm like, holy shit, I'm supposed to pee on that. And it's not, I mean, it's not that I didn't learn things from Sam, but it just, it's closure. It's payback as a bitch. And if anyone was, you know, a fan and a supporter of revenge on a almost satanic basis, it was Sam. And I think that ultimately he would appreciate it. And he's got it coming to some degree. But like I said, I've let it go, but now I've got to sort of like sit with it. So that's sort of happening. That might happen. I'll let you know if I do find a way to go pee on Kennison's grave. And believe me, this is just a debt. It's not even personal anymore. It's just something that you know I need to do. I might need to do it. We'll see. Yeah, I got to really process this. You know, is it a good thing for me to go pee on a grave? Do I need to do that? Have I grown past that? I don't know. So right now, Nicole Holof Center, I just reached out to her because I was thinking about her, because I was thinking about Lynn, and then Michaela Watkins brought it up to me. Michaela called me and said she was looking to cast something in her new movie, and I might be good for it. So Michaela mentioned my name, and then I thought, like, oh, I got to call her or reach out to see if she wants to do the show. Yeah, so this is me talking to Nicole Holof Center, who did not cast me in her new movie, but that's okay. You know, things happen. I might have been perfect for it. Doesn't matter. That kind of stuff doesn't matter in show business. And I turned down stuff too. Who knows what could have happened that didn't? But I do know that I talked to Nicole Holof Center, and this is that.
I don't breathe.
What do you mean don't breathe?
Like when I'm doing one of these and I can tell because I have this on, I hold my breath when I talk.
I hold my breath, you know, a lot.
Me too.
You do?
All day. And at night I have apnea.
Apnea?
Yeah.
Do you wear a machine?
No, I wear a really attractive blue mouth guard.
With a tube, like a tube in it?
No, it just juts your bottom forward like this.
Oh my God.
It opens up.
I hold my breath when I find I hold my breath when I talk because it, I think if I breathe properly, I'd probably cry all the time. I don't know what your problem is.
No, I think the same thing. I've been tempted to take a breathing class.
Really?
But I'm kind of afraid.
Move the mic in.
Are you recording me already?
Sure.
Of course.
What do you mean?
I thought you'd say, okay, go.
What do you mean? Like there would be an intro? No.
Yeah.
Don't be nervous. It's just a conversation. How's your headset? Fine?
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, you sound good. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm weird. I never had allergies, but I have them now. I mean, the last few days have been a little weird. Do you have them?
I do.
Were you fucked up for the last couple of days?
No. Kind of normal.
It? Really?
I have tissue boxes in every corner of my house.
Oh, but so you wouldn't know if the last 2 days were bad or any worse
right.
than last
Probably
week?
Probably not.
Right.
Yeah. No.
I usually don't do anything for them, but I had this Flonase left over, like prescription Flonase.
That's good.
Yeah.
I have one of those.
And a Zyrtec.
Uh-huh. I take a Zyrtec every day.
You do?
Yes.
And it helps?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so that's why I think like I all of a sudden I sound so clear to myself.
Good.
So breathing.
Yeah, so I'll talk and then occasionally I'll have to.
You'll realize I haven't breathed?
Yep.
So why don't you take a breathing class?
I'm afraid.
Afraid of what? Crying?
Like what you said, I'll just never be able to get up again.
Because that's...
I'll pass out.
Because like when I think about just letting it go.
Yeah.
What's all that emotion, right? And I've had that, I think it's always been that way. I've always been a breath holder.
Me too.
You have?
Me too. Yeah.
Are you a mouth breather?
No.
I am. No. So I guess I win.
You do, you're worse. I mean, I love to sing.
Yeah.
But when I sing, like my throat closes up after, like in the middle of a song. I can't go past.
Your throat, you can feel it?
Yeah.
I've been singing in public lately, like in front of people at Largo and stuff, to overcome the fear of that vulnerability. It's a vulnerability thing. the choking and the not breathing. And
isn't it actually like a real thing that you need training to learn how to open up these pipes?
No. Can you sing at home alone without it closing up on you?
Oh, yeah. That.
Right?
True.
So, no, it's all fear-based and it's self-consciousness. And to me, there's something, nothing's more vulnerable than singing for some reason. I don't know why that is.
I don't feel that way.
Oh, I do. That's terrifying.
Are you a good singer?
No, I'm okay.
Sing me a tune.
No, I'm okay. I mean, I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But like the last time I sang, we tried to get through Jealous Guy by John Lennon. And I did it in rehearsal and I know I can do it. But I choked during performing it and I couldn't hit the notes right. And I was so annoyed, but I knew the audience knew me and they were willing. You know, I just said, look, I can't go home not knowing I didn't hit that note. I'll be too, it'd be awful. So we're going to do it again.
Yeah, good. And they loved it, I'm sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they like when people fuck
fail.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to sing with Lynn, actually, a bit. She liked to sing a lot. And she was very good singer.
I know. I watched
singer.
Her birthday video.
Oh, yeah.
Of her singing all those songs. She was great.
Oh, yeah, and I sent you that script that her and I wrote over 5 years. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry I didn't get back to you, but I couldn't follow through on it yet or something. But I like the story.
You were with her for 5 years?
We knew each other a long time. I mean, we knew each other since she did the podcast, right? So like 2015 or 16, I can't remember what it was.
Oh.
And that's when we sort of started engaging. And, you know, one of the ways we would spend time together is to write that fucking script.
Mm-hmm. An excuse, you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it got very close to, you know, getting in, you know, near done. And I still picture it. And I still have a lot of like ideas about how that thing can work and where it would go. But it's pretty close to, the story's all there.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody put it in my head that someone, you know, I should finish it with somebody else. And she's such a fan of yours. So I thought, well, I'm going to send it to you. And then I did. And, I think you liked it, right?
I did like it very much. I was happy to proceed. I mean, I felt honored in many ways.
Well, it's still here. It's still possible.
If you're willing to go for it again. Maybe it's tough.
I don't know if it's tough. It's like, it's about... Like, I know that the issue with her and I was just that, like, you know, I would make her laugh all the time, right? So, and I don't know that what's in there in that script, when I read it over again, how much of the comedy needs to be there. And I think that, I mean, I don't know, your approach to comedy, I think, is different. I don't know that Lynn really did too many comedies other than that last one, which was kind of wacky.
Mm-hmm.
In watching some of your stuff, like, I guess the reason that I'm interested to talk outside of, you know, where you come from in the background, it's like you seem to have a point of view that's evolving and you have specific things that you want to achieve with movies.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I suppose.
Yeah.
Unconsciously.
I guess it's just relative to you as like wherever you're at in your life, right?
Pretty much. Yeah.
But where did you come from?
New York City.
So you're a New York City person?
Mm-hmm.
You grew up there?
I did, until I was 12. And then my family moved to Westwood in Los Angeles.
Really?
Yeah. But my formative years, at least certain ones, were New York for sure.
In the city?
Yeah.
It's so rare to meet people that grew up in New York City. It's like, it's exciting.
Yeah.
So your family's in the arts, right?
Yes. All of them have been.
Yeah. Like what? How? What'd your mom do?
Well, my mom was not until later. She became a set decorator later in life and did a bunch of wonderful films. And
yeah, like which ones?
Sophie's Choice.
Really?
Yeah. Radio Days. Mm. Yeah.
So she became a good set decorator.
Yeah, she did. She was very talented.
Where did that come from, though? What did she do when you were growing up?
Well, she was a secretary and worked at a travel agency. She was an actress when she was younger, actually. But
in
she
movies?
Quit. No, plays and television when she was really young.
Like child actor?
Yeah. And then older, and then a little bit older. And she hung out with James Dean. He asked her out on a date.
Did she go?
No, she was afraid of him. She said, this guy's too creepy for me. And
creepy James Dean.
Creepy. He was creepy. And she told her best friend, you know, he's really cool, but he's creepy. And then her best friend ended up being with him for a long time.
Really?
Because she liked creepy.
Creepy and weird.
Yeah.
Intense and creepy.
Yeah.
Some people like intense and creepy.
I think I do.
Yeah, sure. I think I've always been intense, but the creepy is I shifted a bit. I'm not as creepy as I used to be. I don't think I was ever creepy. I think I was angry, as I'm putting. All right, so okay, but I'm no James Dean. So your mom didn't go out with James Dean?
No, she didn't. She married my father, Larry Hall of Center, instead.
Yeah. What's that guy do?
He was a lyricist, and he booked the Merv Griffin show, and he wrote for your show of shows.
He was a booker on the Merv Griffin show?
Yeah.
And he wrote for your show of shows with Danny Simon and all those guys?
Yeah.
No kidding.
I don't think for very long, but he did. And he wrote lyrics to some theater and acted. And throughout his life, he became a sculptor. I would say that sculpting was his most successful endeavor.
Really?
Yeah. He has this big sculpture in London on Bond Street of Churchill and Roosevelt sitting on a bench, life size. And it's where tourists go and sit between them and take pictures.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it's been photographed more than anything he's ever done.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. First thing it'll come up.
That's interesting, though, like that people just, I like the idea that people, like when they switch jobs, they don't ever think of like doing something mundane or with more security.
No. I'm going to try something harder.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm that way too, but I think it's an artistic sentiment. I don't think that normal people would never do that, whatever normal is.
I know. No, sometimes I think I can't make movies anymore. I'm just going to become an actress. Like, that's wise.
Yeah, good choice.
Yeah.
You can go read for the people that cast your movies.
Exactly.
Just throw me in something.
Yeah.
Is really, that's your plan B?
No.
In your mind?
I couldn't act. I can't. I mean, I think I can act, but I'm too timid to act.
Timid?
Stage fright. Yeah.
You're afraid you're not going to breathe or your throat's going to close up?
And I can't remember my own lines when I'm watching my own scene being filmed.
I think the trick, like, you know, and I'm no genius actor, but I think that if you can not be self-conscious while you're doing it in the middle of all those people, then that's like 70% of it.
Yeah. It's amazing to me. Amazing.
I don't know how it happens where you can just lock in.
I don't either. And people do plays, you know, 3-hour plays.
Well, that's a different thing, the memorizing.
Yeah.
That's different.
It's like another species to me.
So, okay, so your parents, that's what they did.
That's what they did. And then, my mom ended up marrying my stepfather.
Yeah.
Who produced movies.
What was that guy's name?
Charlie Jaffe.
Charlie Jaffe. I remember seeing Charlie Jaffe. He was up there. Well, I had a weird meeting with Jack Rollins once.
Oh, tell me.
But I remember meeting Charlie Jaffe in Montreal at the Montreal Comedy Festival. Mm-hmm. It must have been in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I remember he had some sort of a protege, a woman who was like running his office or something. I just remember there was someone who worked for his production company. Mm-hmm. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
That was sort of a big deal. I don't know. But he was like a big presence, that guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he was sort of holding court, and it was very intimidating because you know,
it was, yeah.
Well, you know that name from all the movies,
right?
You know, Rollins and Jaffe. It was just like it was if you were a Woody Allen fan,
right?
When you could be, it was just always there,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. And he managed a lot of comics, so
yeah, a lot of the Dick Cavett he managed, right? He managed Woody. He managed
Robin Williams.
Oh yeah, that's right. For a while,
Billy Crystal.
So what was it like? How old were you when she married that guy?
I was 8.
So he was like your stepdad?
Yeah.
For real?
He was like another dad, at least for a while. They split up when I was 17, but stayed close, and I stayed close with him, and he, you know, put me through grad school and college, and
really?
Was a, you know, a terrific mentor. Yeah.
Well, so you were around that show business. That's real show business.
I was.
Your whole life?
That period, sure.
Well, what was that like? Who'd you, like, what was the scene? I mean, were people at the house?
There was people at the house. There was a lot of coke.
Oh, really?
A lot of coke.
No kidding. Just around?
It was the 80s.
Yeah?
And yeah.
And the adults then would just do it in public. Like, I remember I had a cousin who worked for Yves Saint Laurent. Like, he's an accountant, and we were at some birthday party for my grandfather, and he's, like, doing blow at dessert. Yeah. Like, it was nothing.
I know.
Like,
well, people wore spoons around their necks, or little vials.
Yeah.
It was nothing.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of coke, and I felt... Unfortunately, I always felt too young to really have the kind of fun I wanted to have with these people. Because, you know, I was 18 or something, or 17, and I thought I wanted to be 25 so I could hang with Robin as an adult and all these people as an adult. But
with Robin Williams? He was around?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Young Robin.
He was sweet, really sweet. And I was privileged to see him do stand-up in the beginning of his career. And
in New York or here? Or had you
both.
Moved here?
Uh-huh. Probably more here.
Right.
Comedy Store.
Yeah, that's where he came down. So, yeah. Okay, so you were how old when they moved out here? So you fought your...
I was 12 when we moved to Los Angeles.
Joffe lived out here?
No, we all lived in New York, and then he moved out here to do more managing and to produce. He wanted to produce TV and movies here, not just Woody.
Right. So that's why you moved, because he moved.
Yeah.
So that was what year? Like
1972.
Oh, my God.
Why?
So you saw the beginning of all of it. Like you would have seen Robin at the Comedy Store in like the late 70s.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So that's all. Yeah. That's when all that started, when those stars were beginning to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, it was thrilling. It was thrilling.
I can't believe it.
I don't know. You know, I got to meet, people I really wanted to meet. That was the best part.
When you were
part.
18 or 19 or 20?
Yeah, maybe a little younger. Like, I remember meeting John Travolta at like the, I don't remember. Maybe I was like 17, you know.
Yeah.
And he got me jobs as a production assistant, maybe one or two.
Oh, yeah, on what? Those are formative.
No kidding. Find out what you're good at and what you're not good at.
Did you?
Oh, I was such a bad PA.
It's the worst because it's humiliating.
Very. And when you're the producer's kid or you know you got your job through nepotism, they run you around.
Yeah.
But also, I'm too logical. Like, they would say, you know, go on that corner and stop traffic.
Yeah.
And there was no traffic.
Right, you just gotta go stand there.
So just go stand there, and I'd say, well, why? There's no traffic. And it's like, just shut up and go stand there.
Right.
You know, so the logic of it made me, you know, furious.
And did you because of that, do you treat your PAs better than that?
Oh, so nice. I know their names. I offer them coffee.
Yeah.
Sometimes I walk by and they won't look up, and it's like, come on, guys.
Right.
I don't know who, Scorsese or whoever wants. Right. Look, have eye contact.
So what were you PA on? Like, what did you...
I was a PA on one of Woody's lighter films, A Midsummer Night Sex Comedy.
Yeah.
I was a PA or apprentice editor on Hannah and Her Sisters.
Apprentice editor. So you that was sort of what you were heading for?
Maybe, yeah. I was just syncing dailies and stuff like that. But at that point, I knew I wanted to do something in film, but I thought it could be production design or editing. It didn't even occur to me to do or to write.
Yeah.
I always loved writing.
How much did like Rollins and Joffe have to do with the movies at that point? Like really, you know, in terms of later in the, you know, like.
Later, not so much.
Did you learn anything about production at that time? Did you understand how it was all structured and all that?
No.
No.
And I wasn't interested either. I'm still not very interested.
He's just like, who's going to give me money?
Exactly. And why aren't they?
Yeah.
What do I got to do?
So is this where you learned or did you go to school?
Went to school.
Here?
I went to many undergraduate schools.
Oh, good.
It took me 6 years to get a bachelor's degree.
It took me 5.
Okay.
Only because I just wanted to stay one more year so I could drink more and do drugs.
That's a good reason.
Sure.
I was just confused.
I was confused too.
Yes, but faster.
Much
in
faster.
In 5, you were confused for 5. I was confused for 6.
Where'd you go? Which ones did you go
through? I started at Sonoma State. Then I went to San Francisco State.
Uh-huh.
Then I went to NYU.
Whoa.
And graduated.
From NYU?
Yeah. I started taking film classes.
Yeah.
And graduated with a terrible, terrible short film that was painful to make. And I thought, I can't do this.
What was that?
It was actually about me and my sister visiting my father in the country on weekends. It was called Every Other Weekend and a Month in the Summer. And it was bad. And I had kind of a panic attack the entire time I was making it. And so I thought, well, I can't do this.
So that it was a concern that because of the reasons why you were having it, you wouldn't be able to do it direct.
Correct.
Why were you having it? Just because everything was so...
I don't know. I was overwhelmed. It just wasn't ready.
Huh.
And I also felt like I needed to know everything. And the DP who shot my short, you know, was a jerk and, you know, an asshole DP guy. But I was just overwhelmed.
In college,
yeah.
You had an asshole DP.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder.
Oh,
how.
They start young.
Well, I always went, before I started making any television or being part of it,
yeah,
I thought that the director had to know everything. And I guess it's right. really relative to how you delegate, mm-hmm. you know, responsibility and who you trust. I mean, but I imagine yeah. you do have to have a handle on most things. But,
sure.
But eventually you learn how to trust your DP or trust, you know, the other people. And,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. But I know what I want and I know what I don't want. And that is very helpful.
Well, what were you gunning for, like, at the beginning? Because I watched some of the first movie, the first feature, Walking mm-hmm. and Talking, yeah. recently. I mean, when you were doing a short, you know, what was it you were trying to do and who were, you know, who was your influences?
I don't know.
You don't know.
I can't answer any of that.
Well, you know, any of it, even what the story was, just, you just picked a story.
I picked this really personal story about yeah. my sister and I visiting my father.
Yeah.
And the horrible routine. Oh, and I had a stepmother who disliked my sister and myself dearly. And so it was about her kind of making our visit to my dad really crummy.
So in some ways, you know, it was sort of a template for...
Totally.
For everything you've done.
Everything I've done. And in fact, my stepmother had started to talk about her sex life and how... with my father, and yeah. that it was very disappointing, uh-huh. you know, and I was like 9.
Yeah.
So it was traumatic, and that's what the movie
that really
was
happened.
About. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Isn't it weird that there's no, like my father, before he got the brain problem, whatever the hell's happening, there's no statute, the statute of limitations runs out at some point when people get a certain age as to what they can and can't tell their kids.
Yes.
And it's a very jarring thing because they don't realize it. And that's sort of where that joke that I've been working on about, you know, gaslighting and parenting come mm-hmm. from, is that like when they divulge this stuff, you're like, well, if I had known that,
right,
I could have made entirely different decisions for myself.
Like what?
Well, I mean, look, it's not about decisions, but like I knew on some level, I think, you know, after a certain point that my dad was a philandering, you know, mm-hmm. guy. Mm. You know, and I've had my own issues with that. But, like, you know, stuff that he has told me, I'm like, holy shit. I mean, you know, this has been going on for that long. And all that stuff, you know, all the stuff that they hid from you is implanted in you, the behavior.
Right, right.
Like, they can't hide, you know.
Well, I don't have to know about their sex life for it to impact me
right.
and my sex life.
No, you don't have to know. But, like, it does, like, what that did was shine some light on my father's character.
Right.
Right. So, you know, I knew he was, you know, bipolar. I knew he was selfish. But, you know, some of the stuff he told me, I'm like, oh, you're a fucking monster.
No wonder I felt bad all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Could give a shit.
Yeah. I mean, I have kids and sometimes they'll ask me a question and without thinking, I'll just answer it. And then the look on their face.
How old are they?
Like, they're 24.
Okay.
So slowly, you know, they're asking me things about private things. And
when they were kids?
Like, they like, started when, I don't know, one.
No, about when they were kids?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like stuff like when
yes.
we were, yeah.
Yeah, or before.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm divorced, so they're finding things out about our marriage that, uh-huh. you know, that never occurred to them to ask. And sometimes I just blurt out an answer and I see their face and it's like they were not ready to hear that answer.
Right.
What was I thinking?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they're adults.
They are, and they're different from one another. Like, one asks more questions than the other often. So, they're different people. Yeah.
So, like, all right, so when did you start, when did you overcome whatever?
Yeah.
Like, what's interesting to me in terms of looking at, you know, the stuff you've done is, like, I think the last time I talked to you, you were going or just back from writing with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, were you mm-hmm. just going to Ireland? I don't remember when I sent you that script. Were you back? Because it was middle of COVID, but it was...
Huh? I have no idea.
Okay. But, like, you know, you did that thing, and I love yeah. that movie.
You did?
I did.
Good.
And I don't think they could have made it without you.
Right.
In terms of your
well,
point of view.
Well, politically, they also couldn't have made it without
me. Well, I get
me.
That, but yeah. still, like, you know, I don't know that you could trust those two guys to, you know, conceive of a woman's point of view, or Ridley.
Right.
You know, you know, so, like... Any of that, I have to assume, was your input.
Yes, it was.
So then when I look at that, which should have been a big movie, but I think, I don't know what the fuck happened.
It just tanked.
I know, but I talked to Ridley about it, and he just, I think they didn't know how to sell it. And, you know, he was like, I don't remember what he said, but he didn't think that was it. But because it's a nice grown-up movie that kind of retrofits some, you know, real issues that are relevant now into a into an amazingly, you know, timeless story.
I couldn't imagine it would be anything but a success, really. And it got good reviews.
Yeah, I just really think people didn't know what to do with it. They saw a coming attraction, and they were like, maybe I'm done with the Game of Thrones business.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know what they...
Yeah.
But it's a very sophisticated movie. Yeah. So when I saw that, and then kind of looking back through, you know, how you've handled your career in terms of, you know, doing your own movies, but writing and directing on other people's stuff, and directing, obviously, it's a job you do sometimes.
Yes, for TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's just the way you got to be.
Yeah.
In order to keep, you know, doing what you want to do.
Practicing and making money. I mean, those are good things to direct.
Sure. How did you overcome the fear at first?
Well, I graduated and I thought, okay, I'm just going to be a writer. I'm going to try to be a writer. So I was writing a bunch of scripts, and then I met these people who had gone to Columbia Film School through some friends, and they said what a great school it was, and they were working writers, and they suggested I go there.
Yeah.
And so I did. And as soon as I got there, it was the right place, and you have to direct videos of your work and other people's work. It's part of the screenwriting program, too. And I found myself to be good at it and confident. It was smaller and more
videos
manageable.
Videos as a way to learn?
Yeah, short films. Yeah, like scenes.
Instead of like doing 16 millimeter and processing.
A $20,000 16 millimeter student film that sucked. I mean, what a waste of everything.
Right. So videos is almost...
Oh, no, that wasn't that one. That much money. But yeah. So practice.
Yeah,
it's like I just needed a lot of practice, and I found that I was good and that I loved doing it, and I had some great teachers, and so I made a short film coming out of there.
And you liked that one?
Yeah, that one was called It's Richard I Love. And
what was that about?
It was about Cynthia Nixon starring in it.
Yeah.
A girl who loves this guy who just didn't give a shit about her. Not that, you know, that's ever happened to me or anything. and Keith Gordon played the guy, and it was in New York, and it was really fun, really fun. And it turned out pretty well. And it, you know, it got me, I think, got me an agent.
Yeah.
And I wrote a few scripts that got nowhere.
For other things or for yourself?
Myself. Uh-huh. And then...
Movies, whole movies.
Yeah, but they didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
And then I wrote Walking and Talking, and I met Ted Hope, who was starting Good Machine in New York, which was, you know, the place to be if you want to make an independent film.
Was this the beginning of independent films, kind of?
Was this during
the boom?
Yeah, it was. Like, they'd just done Ed Burns' movie and Hal Hartley's movies. And,
oh, yeah. It was like Living in Oblivion.
Yeah. Tom DiCillo.
Right.
Movies.
And Hal Hartley was the, what was his first movie?
Trust and Unbelievable Truth with,
Adrian Shelley.
Adrian Shelley.
Who I went to college with briefly.
You did?
Yeah.
She was lovely, huh?
I knew her husband. Yeah. And I knew her a little bit. Yeah. Terrible. Jesus. Terrible story.
Unreal.
So that was sort of like... It's the middle of the wave of independent filmmaking, kind of.
Yeah, I was really in the right place at the right time. It also took me 6 years to make the movie after I'd written it and met with Ted. Yes.
For Walking and Talking?
Yeah.
And, well, it seems like that some of that stuff is in there, the unrequited love business and, you know, understanding relationships. And it seems like that's, but that, like I said before, it seems to be sort of a through line through all the movies. I don't guess we ever really nail it, do we?
I hope not because I'd have no material.
So when you did that, because you definitely, I try to watch what, you know, choices directors make and how they handle actors. But and it seems like, you know, the way you write is very, you know, it's a naturalistic thing, and it takes a certain type of actor to be able to do it. It's not the difference between, it's really kind of amazing the difference between a standard mainstream movie and a movie that someone has a little more freedom to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, there's scenes in that one and in Walking and Talking that are very, they're very naturalistic. And I imagine, were they improv'd, any of them?
Probably not.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I wouldn't say a whole scene, but a line here or two.
Sure.
I mean, Liev was great at it. And, Yeah, Keener was. Everybody was.
Yeah.
So if some actor says a terrific line while we're shooting, I keep it. That's great. I mean, I gave them the freedom to do that. But basically stick to the script. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, it would be chaos.
And was that... Well, no one knew who Keener was, right?
She'd been in Johnny Suede and Living in Oblivion.
Yeah. But Walking Talking, I think, was... She kind of broke out of that one, right? That was like a big...
Maybe. I can't take credit for
discovering
her. What
about Leah? Had he been in some...
He had been in The Day Trippers, Greg Mottola's movie.
Oh, yeah. I just watched that recently, too.
It's good.
It is good.
Yeah. So I saw him in that. I went to school with Greg. I was friends with Greg. And
were at Columbia?
Yeah.
He was one of them.
Yeah.
What's he doing now? Didn't he do a big movie recently?
Yeah. I think, I don't know, right now he's in Portugal posting pictures. I don't know if he's on vacation or not.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's made some great stuff.
And Anne Heche?
Super bad. Anne Heche?
Yeah.
I haven't talked to Anne Heche.
No, but I mean, like, she was in that movie. That was kind of early in her trip, too, right?
Very.
Yeah.
She was kind of more of an unknown.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And I had to cast people who were kind of up and coming.
Yeah.
I'd seen Kevin Corrigan in The Slums of Beverly Hills.
Oh, yeah. He's like the New York indie actor guy. Like, he's kind of shows up. He's ever present for about a decade.
I know. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And he was in, I put him in Please Give, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's
so
unique.
What happened? So you put this movie together. It takes you 6 years to make.
Yeah.
Now, is there any input? Do you show it to your stepdad?
Yeah. I remember he was very critical because it had a lot of explicit sex in it, more than what ended up in the film. I mean, I rewrote it essentially for 6 years. So he didn't like that. He didn't like reading that.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, when he saw the crappy film I made at NYU... He did say, I think you should think about doing something else, Nick. He did.
Uh-huh.
And then by the time I made Walking and Talking, he was a full believer.
Oh, yeah?
Completely, supportive.
Supportive?
Yeah.
So what happens then? Because I don't really understand. Like, I know, like, I kind of know how indie film works. But, like, you've done a lot of them. So after Walking and Talking, were there people willing to bank on you?
Barely.
Barely.
I mean, it did well. It got great reviews. But it was really hard to get financing for my second movie. It didn't take 6 years. And...
Did you have it written already? Lovely
no,
and Amazing?
No.
No.
No, definitely not. I do one script at a time, like every 4 years. It's really
and that's okay.
Disappoint. Well, no. But I am who I am.
You have some acceptance around that?
I mean, it's not broken.
Yeah.
I wish that I had made and will make a lot more movies, but I don't see myself doing that.
Why?
Because I don't have a lot of ideas that I want to see through.
Yeah.
That I want to live with for 3 years.
What determines that? Just a feeling?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if I think I have an idea, I'll sort of sort through my notes and write. And then if it's boring or stupid, I give it up.
Yeah.
So, and I just don't have inspiring ideas very often.
Well, I mean, did Walking and Talking at least, it seems like that got you... in the door with directing television, right?
Walking and Talking, yeah, it did everything that I wanted it to do. I got, right after that, my first directing television job was Sex and the City, and only because they saw Walking and Talking.
Okay.
I got some residual checks yesterday from Sex and the City.
Really?
Still, yeah.
Are they still, like, meaty or no?
Mostly, like, 300, oh, that's 400, good. Sometimes more.
That's nice.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I mean, that's a long time ago.
Well, then I imagine that being able to do that and move kind of, job to job a bit with TV directing, it takes the pressure off finding that idea to do the next movie.
It does. And it gives me practice because I direct movies so infrequently. It's like, oh, do I remember how to talk to an actor?
Well, is it giving you practice? Did you have to sort of frame it like that way at some point? Did you have to convince yourself that it's giving you practice as opposed to, standing in the way of you making another movie?
Yeah. Yeah, this is good practice for my next film, whenever that might be.
Right,
yeah. Yeah.
But you always think about making the movie, you know?
Yes.
You don't think like, oh, I'm just going to direct television.
No. But, you know, if that ends up happening to me in my old age, I'll take it.
But Lovely and Amazing was, it was worth the wait. It was a bigger movie.
Actually, I got less money for
but
Lovely
it got
and
more,
Amazing.
Didn't it get more attention?
Yes, definitely. It definitely got more attention. Right, that was Lionsgate. And it was still only like $1 million, but I think it's a more mature effort.
And like Jake Gyllenhaal was like 12 years old. How
yeah,
old was
he
it?
Was 20.
He was 20.
He turned 21 right around
It's crazy how young he looks.
Yeah, because he is young.
I know.
They all are. I mean,
Keener's in that one too.
Yeah, and Emily Mortimer and
Dermot Mulroney.
Dermot's in it, and yeah.
He's
and
kind
Clark
of.
Gregg.
And that guy that I liked, that James LaGrosse guy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what happened to that guy? I thought I always liked seeing him, like in Drugstore Cowboy. I thought he was amazing.
He was.
And then he'd show up here and there.
Yeah.
And then it just, I don't
He's
know.
A really good actor.
He is.
And a really nice guy.
I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah.
It turns out when you ask that about people now, they've done a million things and you just didn't.
You have no idea.
Yeah. Everyone's doing a million things.
Or they're just enjoying their lives and, you know,
yeah.
not necessarily making movies or whatever. I mean, he's a country boy.
How about Dorf, like coming out of nowhere, like yeah, Stephen Dorf. I mean, he's not in your movie, but like, you just reminded me, like he's out there in Malibu. He loves his life, mm-hmm. and then he's like, right now, mm-hmm. after whatever the hell he's been through, or whatever, wherever his career went, he's doing the best work of his entire life.
In what?
In that in the True Detective.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Oh my God. He's fucking amazing.
Wow. Good. That's
just,
great.
Fucking amazing. Like, I was watching it, and I'm like, who is that? And they're like, it's Dorf. I'm like, what? And I had to interview him. But I just uh-huh. watched Old Henry. Did you see Old Henry?
No.
With Tim Blake Nelson? That
no.
weird little Western?
No.
Dorf's in that as a heavy, and he's fucking great.
Wow.
I'm sorry. I don't know
good
why I'm getting
him.
All excited about it. People should see that Old Henry movie.
Okay. I love Tim Blake Nelson.
It's a classic story. It's a classic Western story. Based on a classic Western story in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't know the twist, it's worth seeing.
Okay. I don't know it, so don't
You should
tell
watch
me.
It. Do okay. you like Westerns?
No.
Okay, good. You'll love it then.
No Country for Old Men. That's my idea of
that
Western.
That was the extent? Yeah. Well, what do you like? What are the movies that were like, oh my God?
Slasher films.
Come on.
Oh my God. I mean, so many movies. I mean, Spike Jonze's movies and Charlie Kaufman's movies.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I grew up loving Woody and Albert Brooks.
Albert.
And James Brooks and...
James Brooks, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Hal Ashby is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I met him once. I made a fool out of myself.
What happened? When was this?
Oh, I was really young. And I was just, I think I was maybe 18 years old.
Mm.
And I didn't know what he looked like. And Harold and Maude, of course, was my favorite movie. And I was introduced to him. And this is Hal Ashby. And I just lost my shit. You're? Oh, my God. Yeah, I think I pounded the table he was sitting at.
Yeah.
But he was fine.
I've done that.
Yeah. Haven't we all?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But I did it last week with Keith Richards. The second time.
Really?
The second time I interviewed him. And this was on Zoom. And I was still like, oh, my God. You know, so.
How was he with that?
It's great.
He just like kind of smirked.
Well, he's great. You know, he's like, you know, a lot of these guys who are such, you know, kind of menacing presences are just like, you know, turning into sweet old men.
Yeah. Finally.
It's like, yeah. It's the best thing that can happen.
I don't
know
how you can interview all the people you do and keep your wits about you.
What do you mean?
Well, not that you're not.
You mean not lose my shit?
Yeah, like that. I mean,
well, I mean, if you listen to the first interview, I kind of lost my shit, but okay. I was still, you know, engaging.
You could speak.
And I was in this one too. I'm very obsessed with this hat, which to the point, you know, his people got mad at me.
Like, stop talking about the hat.
Yes, and I was like, I was like, Keith, where do you get these beanies? Because he's like, he looks great right now, and I don't know why I think that I. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to have Keith Richards' guitar. But at this point, he's like, what is he, 80? And he's wearing a beanie. And I'm like, I got to get a Keith beanie.
He got him at Urban Outfitters like everybody else.
No, it turns out he didn't. He turns out, he got him at a place that sells $400 cashmere beanies.
And they sent him a case.
I don't know how it worked for him, but I had to pay for two.
You paid $800 for some lame beanies.
I did. And they're not even here yet. I can't even tell you if they're the right ones. I just hope they're the right ones.
They look good.
Even if I don't wear them. You know, I had to because I shared it with the world, my obsession with the beanie. So I have to follow through. Yeah. Whether I want to or not.
Yeah.
Even though the world would be like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah, you
spend
$800. Spoiled idiot.
What the, yeah. I got no kids.
Right.
I got no debt. Can I buy a beanie?
You're allowed.
Uh-oh. This is the exciting. On Fridays when I do interviews, we have a little extra texture with the leaf blower.
Which is illegal.
Is it?
Yeah, but we need our leaf blowers.
Oh, the gas ones are illegal now? I think they can use electric, can't they?
Isn't that the deal? I don't know.
Isn't that the shift we're supposed to be making? Out of gas into electric and chargeable? I can't fucking stand it anymore, Nicole. I can't stand it.
Which?
The leaf blowers.
Oh.
Because when you live in a neighborhood like this, every fucking day.
Yeah.
Every day there's one right there.
You poor thing.
Do you have that where you live?
Yeah. But I'd want my leaves to go away.
I want my leaves to go away, but I think they should all be done on the same day. Like, there should be 2 days a week where everyone can do that.
Yeah.
So at least you have like 1 or 2 days a week.
You can just split.
Just be quiet. Just have a quiet morning. Is that so hard?
That's what happens when you live in a nice, leafy neighborhood.
Okay, fine. You're saying I have luxury problems? I should shut the fuck up?
Yeah.
So, speaking of luxury problems, like Friends with Money, I do remember that movie very well.
Oh, good.
And it was one of those movies where it's like, you know, some people are really going to be bothered by this movie because of the way these people live. Which is like we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And what were you, when you made that movie with those women?
Was I thinking?
Well, no, but I mean, were you like, these are my friends? I'm going to be honest.
Oh, what do you mean?
Well, this is the world I live in?
Oh, yeah. Because I also am representing their faults and their limitations.
For sure. Yeah.
And, you know, that's what it's about. So it was also, you know, not at a time where I think we have to be much, much more conscious about the movies we make right now and the audience for them. I don't think I could make that movie now.
Why?
Bunch of white people in a white people problem movie. And
yeah,
I mean, I'm about to make another one. And I think, you know, that's not been easy because of that.
Huh.
Because of the climate right now.
Scott Kahn was good.
Wasn't he?
Yeah.
He's funny.
He is funny.
Yeah. I liked working with him a lot. He was very game.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone, I had a really great experience on that
movie. It was a great cast. It was Aniston and, Joan Cusack.
Yeah.
Francis.
I got to work with my idols, so I was just pinching myself. I mean, I'd been chasing Joan Cusack since Working Girl.
Yeah?
And I couldn't get the agent to even, you know.
Yeah, how does that work? Like, when you want somebody, how does it, like, how often do you get them? I mean, obviously, Keener you've been working with forever.
Mm-hmm.
But Frances McDormand?
I guess that script. Uh-huh. I mean, or they liked, I mean, the movie I made before it was Lovely and Amazing. So I guess if they saw that and they liked it and, you know, good female parts don't come around.
I think also like within that movie and like in the Friends with Money thing, I mean, there must be some element of like purging, you know, or owning the lifestyle that we kind of live.
Yeah, well, I think all my movies have that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they're so autobiographical that I'm willing to show my shallow life. And I guess...
Is it shallow?
So in some ways, I mean, it's definitely self-absorbed.
Yeah.
And that my movies are about my own self-absorption and my friends and the world. But I'm curious about so many things in human behavior that I hope I'm also expressing that.
Yeah.
The depth of human behavior in people you might think of as shallow or...
Just by getting to the core of humanness is really the thing that kind of undermines shallowness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That we're all people.
Yeah.
I mean, I did make fun of that in Friends with Money with Joan Cusack and Greg German, who are the rich couple.
Right, right.
And they have great sex and they smell good and they have no problems. Yeah. And I let that be. Like, maybe that is, you know, what it's like. Of course it's not, but
it
was fun.
Right?
No, of course not.
I have real problems with that. I think, like, you know, when we're all, I don't think we're all narcissists, but we're certainly self-centered. And how much of what we think other people are doing or living is something we're just making up all the time.
Say that again? I'm sorry.
We make up other people's lives. You know, we make assumptions based on nothing.
Oh,
I do it all the fucking time.
Yeah.
And there, I guess there's really no way you can know unless you really know those people. Or you need, you don't know how fragile the dynamic is. Like, even in that first movie, Walking and Talking with those two girls, I mean, those two women, mm-hmm. as they become women, you know, and also the way you establish stuff when people are kids, I think, is very good. I like that screenplay you wrote for that horrifying story about the two girls that kill the black baby.
Oh, thank you.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
But dealing with, like, young people and dealing with the impact of those moments is kind of crazy. But mm-hmm. my point is, you know, you don't even know your best friends, really.
Sure you do.
You know what they do and you know how they react to you, but there's always room for surprise.
Always, absolutely. And They're never exactly what you want them to be at all times.
Do you have best friends?
Yeah, I do.
For a long time?
Yes. Yeah. Very, very lucky. Since high school and college, we're still very close.
Really?
And some more college. And I've made some new friends, which is amazing.
Recently?
To me, too. Yeah, kind of.
Huh.
Isn't that weird?
A little bit.
And it's really nice.
It always seems to take a little more effort than I'm.
It does.
And I always get very disappointed when sometimes where, you know, like, okay, we're going to try to be friends. And you have that one friend date. And it's just sort of like, I guess it didn't work out.
Guess you didn't like me that much.
Something. Well, there's a kid that I do comedy with who went on a hike with me once. Mm-hmm. And we work together at the comedy store all the time. And sometimes I bring him up and I say, well, this guy, we tried to be friends, but didn't happen. We went on a...
What does he say?
Well, he's got a good sense of humor.
Yeah.
He's kind of an asshole, but a funny asshole.
That's funny. Yeah. It's harder to make friends when you're older, but they actually do what I do.
Yeah.
And that... is really nice. I didn't always have so many friends in the movie business, but it's really nice to have people to complain to on the same level
in this world that we live in.
Yeah, and learn from, and yeah.
So how do you make friends? You know, later in life, just change your expectations.
Lower the bar?
Yeah, not lower the bar, but like it seems like the ones that are older and been through everything with you, are like. They know you when you're like, I need to, we gotta, you know, and that tends to go away, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. No, actually, not really.
Yeah.
The new friends, I don't know, they kind of materialized naturally, met them, you know, with mutual friends. And then it's like, hey, should we get together? Which is a little scary. And you get together and actually it was kind of nice. And then... when do we stop talking about work? When do we start talking about personal things? And then we do, then you realize you're friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My boundaries don't enable me to, like, lately, I just, like, certain people have just, I get exhausted and I don't want to fucking.
I know. I mean, I'd be your friend, but you live too far away.
Yeah. I
don't want to be my friend.
I do want to be your friends, but. I don't think I'm clear as to, you know, like I have like one or two people where I'm like can see me mm-hmm. properly
mm-hmm.
and it's a relief,
mm-hmm.
but I can't break any new people in.
I understand breaking new people. It's pretty funny.
Well, I used to do a bit about that, about how, like, you know, who are these people with many friends? All you need are two. You need the main guy and the guy you go to when you drain the main guy.
That's pretty true. I'm terrified that, you know, they're going to die before me, and I don't know what I'm going to do. But we don't have to go there.
What a ridiculous fucking life. All right, so when you decide to write a movie
mm-hmm.
or direct, I don't know. Have you directed like whole movies that weren't yours?
No. I almost never. Did.
What happened?
A couple of times. Well, I was going to direct several movies. Every Secret Thing, that one about the dead baby, I was going to direct.
It felt like you should have directed it.
Well, thanks. But I wrote the script intending to direct it, and I couldn't nail the script. I couldn't nail it.
What do you mean?
There was just a character in it that I couldn't solve.
Which one?
The detective, the main uh-huh. person who...
Not Elizabeth Banks?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I also, that was the main reason. But I think I was also a little afraid to deal with the dead baby and the screaming baby. My kids were younger in the editing room, like living with that.
Oh. Really? So
yeah.
That was an obstacle. But you, what do you mean you couldn't nail the character? You were afraid you couldn't direct it because you didn't quite understand it yet?
Yeah.
You were able to write it?
No, I couldn't write her well.
Well, then who wrote it?
Well, I guess Amy Berg took over. And.
But did she change the script?
Probably some. Oh. Yeah. And, you know, I was going to direct what became 50-50.
Yeah.
And I was going to direct it, and I worked with the writer, and it was really fun. All these guys, they were great. And I thought it was going to be shot in L.A., and they decided to shoot it in Vancouver. And part of the reason why I could do it was because it was in L.A.
Yeah.
At the time, one of my sons was in a new school and was getting bullied.
Oh.
And I couldn't leave him. I just couldn't leave him.
Really?
Yeah.
How old was that kid?
It was like the beginning of middle school, 12 or something.
Well, that's good that you prioritized your family over the career.
I know, I'm a fool, but I would do it again. And, but, you know, they weren't happy, but it turned out really well.
Well, let me ask you, because, you know, I know that Lynn, you know, it being my point of reference with, you know, people who are directing movies and independent directors, like, mm-hmm. there is a point where, like, she really needed to do it her way.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, to the point where the one experience I think she had when she was given a bigger movie was not great.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
Laggies.
Oh.
And I think it was a little difficult with all the people who had power.
Right.
You know, even in directing some television, I think it was similar.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
To the point where, like, I really wonder, like, because clearly when she died, you know, things were turning and it was going to be a bigger career. Mm-hmm. But I really wonder how it would have panned out if someone said, will you direct this Marvel movie?
Yeah.
What would you do?
I wouldn't do it. Mm. I'd be, you know, crazy, but I wouldn't do it. I don't think, well, because, I don't know, life's too short.
Yeah, and when you direct a movie, it's a couple of years at least.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
And to direct a Marvel movie would, I imagine, be a lot of ulcers, a lot of stomach and knots.
And also, how do you represent your point of view? I mean, that's what you're used to, making movies.
Yeah, yeah. No, it would be, some people, I guess, feel excited by that challenge. I wouldn't feel excited by that particular challenge.
Well, what about any big movie?
Well, yeah, if I think it's great, sure.
Yeah, right.
And if I could make a lot of money one day, that would be really nice. But it hasn't happened. Yeah, it hasn't happened.
Well, I like to please give. I don't remember if I saw it. Sorry.
You should see Enough Said. Julia Louis-Dreyfus and James
Gandolfini. Oh, no, I did see it. I did. It was the last one before he died.
Yeah.
You know what I remember about that movie?
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, that, you know, clearly James was trying to, you know, do something other than Tony Soprano.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, trying, and just, I remember his performance very specifically and realizing that he was a great actor with an amazing range. And it was mm-hmm. kind of interesting mm-hmm. to see how vulnerable he could get.
Yeah. Cool.
So I remember all that.
That's a good
and
takeaway.
And you did that?
I did, but he was ready. He was there. I didn't have to do much.
Yeah.
No.
It seemed like he died before it came out, didn't it?
Yes, he did. He died right after he did some ADR, and that was the only time he saw scenes from the movie, and he was really hard on himself and didn't want to see any cuts. And when he did see some pieces in ADR, yeah. I don't know, he hung his head. He was like, oh, God, I would look like such a pussy.
What?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was so afraid I was going to make him. And I was like, yeah, your character's a pussy.
Yeah.
And we all love him. And get over it.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, he died like a couple of weeks after that.
Fucking brutal, man.
Yeah. Really sad. Really, really sad.
And Julia is like fucking amazing.
Mm-hmm. She is amazing. She's going to be in my next movie.
What's it about? You don't have to tell if it's going to ruin it for you.
Ruin it for me.
Well, I mean, like...
Well, it's a lot of family dynamics. Mm. It's comedy, drama, and it's a lot about how to support those you love without having to lie to them.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean...
Is that possible?
No. And if you over
spoiler alert.
And if you over support your kid,
yeah.
Your kid wants to prove you wrong. It just stuff like that. So families this is where, and relationships. And,
but this is where all these things live with your characters in movies that you know, that there's this fundamental unsolvable tension to relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't there always?
But and I guess that even though you know that, I'm saying you as people, you still try to control or you know have a handle on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to let go.
I mean, I don't solve anything. Mm-hmm. It's really just exploring how and why and can we, and because I don't have any answers. And, you know, people will say, oh, now that you wrote about that, are you over it? And it's like, not at all. Not in the least.
Yeah, because you have to deal with it every day on some level if there's other people involved in your life.
Yeah.
But the Land of Steady Habits, that was like, you know, that was like the outer edges of of what people can go through and handle.
Pretty bad. Really sad. You didn't like it?
I loved it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
That guy, it's Mendelsohn, right?
Yeah.
He's like something else, that guy.
He's genius. I just
How's he doing?
Love him. Oh, God.
You got to call him?
I sent him a text.
Yeah.
And he sent me a text right back.
Yeah.
And I was so happy to get it.
Yeah.
And then it promptly went out of my head.
You forgot. And now it's just hanging there.
Yeah.
How long has it been?
A couple of weeks.
Oh.
A week.
Yeah. I do that all the time.
I love him. You do? I do too. I'm like so happy to hear from them. And then.
Well, some part of your brain registers it and it closes the file.
Right.
You're like,
maybe,
oh.
Right.
Yeah. And it's just like, I did that. And then you realize like, oh, I probably could have said something more. I
could have responded.
Exactly.
And it has nothing to do with how important that person is to me. That's what's scary because I adore him.
Every few days, maybe once a week, you got to scroll through your text and answer.
And not remember when you're on air. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's nice. It was a real moment.
It was.
Yeah. It was a good moment.
Yeah.
Off script. Off, you know.
Otherwise,
narrative.
This is all scripted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Personal script.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that movie was great. I liked
good.
It.
Thank you.
Because it just kept getting worse and worse.
It did.
Yeah.
It did. I really loved the book. And people were like, why do you want to make this movie? And it's just, I don't know. It was a good book. It was a good story.
You like adapting books?
I liked adapting that one.
Yeah.
And I liked adapting Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Did you want to direct that?
I was going to direct that.
What happened with that one? What family trauma?
You don't know? You didn't look it up?
No, I'm not great at research. Sorry.
When you interviewed Obama, I bet you did some research.
Yeah, but I hate doing that. That made it a very sort of like regimented interview.
Right.
Like I'd rather miss things and have a real conversation than, you know too much going in.
I've heard you say that I didn't want to read your book before.
The only time I'll read books is if I don't know about the person or I'm not sure they can talk. And the problem with reading people's books is you'll lead them and you already know all the answers.
Right, right.
So, but like, it's not books with you. But I mean, I don't, was there some sort of controversy?
It was horrible.
Oh.
Okay. I mean, I adapted it to direct and cast it. Julianne Moore.
Yeah.
Was going to be in it.
Yeah. I love her.
And we started working on the character and we got it. We didn't see eye to eye.
You and Julianne Moore.
Yeah. She wanted very much to do it her way.
Yeah.
And to sort of keep me out of it, which I was unaccustomed to.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know if she works that way always, but that was my experience. And so literally 5 days before shoot, I mean, everything was done.
Yeah.
I let her go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You fired Julianne Moore. Because you knew it wouldn't work with what you had pictured it to be.
Correct. And I didn't think it was going to be any fun. Mm. Like, I had a knot in my stomach.
And you wanted to tell a story.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And socially, I adored her.
Yeah.
I did. But I felt like this is going to be a battle. And I think she felt it, too, but was willing to go ahead. And
well,
out
of curiosity, now that we all know how McCarthy did it.
Yeah.
What was it about, again, the thing that, I don't know.
So different.
Yeah, well, McCarthy's got this built-in you know, comedy engine that makes even her most, you know, pathetic and craven emotional impulses, you know, not so menacing.
Right, right.
Yeah.
More lovable.
Right.
I think that with Julie, she would have been closer to Lee Israel in terms of that.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, she's incredibly talented actor. I don't change my mind about that. It just was not a good fit.
And then what happened?
And then Searchlight, who made the movie, said, do you want to push it for 2 weeks and see if you can recast it?
Yeah.
And I tried.
Yeah.
And no one was available that I wanted. And they said, do you want to come back in a year and try it over? And I felt like I'd made the movie. I mean, when you're 5 days away from shooting.
You laid it all out.
Every silverware, the kind of clothes, the shoes, the locations, everything has been chosen.
Right.
And I was exhausted and burnt. And I said no.
Mm.
So, of course, when Marielle Heller made such a great movie and incredibly successful, what was I thinking? But, you know, she did a great job and I got a lot of attention and Academy Award nomination for it. And, you know, sadly, it's kind of the movie people will say to me that they love the most of my films.
Right.
But I didn't direct it.
But you said,
so
but
it's
kind
of a mix.
You can take half ownership.
Exactly. It's a little bittersweet.
Right. But do you regret it?
I don't know. It would have been a different film. So
who were you thinking?
Oh, no, I don't want to. Yeah. Lots of people who were about to go on vacation or, you know, couldn't do it. Yeah.
Interesting. So, but are you happy with the way it?
Yeah, very much. Mm. Yeah. I mean, there's certain things I would have done differently, but I think it was really good. Obviously, people love that movie.
Now, when you like, what do you think is your strong suit as a director? Because what do you do? Do you work pretty close with actors? I mean,
yeah, I don't do a ton of rehearsal.
No. Yeah.
I like it fresh, and I give them freedom to tell me what they think stinks.
Yeah.
And to say something better if they want to, or I think I'm a pretty disarming person.
Yeah.
And I think that it helps them to feel safe.
Yeah.
To try things and be stupid, and I respect them so much for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it starts with the writing. I think that I don't ask actors generally to behave in a way that isn't natural or human.
Right. And when you know, like, I guess the trick to directing is when you do a take, it's just somehow in your gut, you know, when it's the right one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems to be the whole thing. Because and it's a unique, and especially when you do movies like you do, where it's all sort of about the emotional honesty of any given scene.
Right.
It's not about whether, you know, the pyrotechnics worked or the car blew up at the right time.
No, that would be so boring. It's like, did
easier
their chin
to,
quiver?
Easier to read. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Did their chin quiver? Did their eyes tear up?
Yeah,
or did
yeah.
they surprise me in some fantastic way? I mean, if you cast really good actors and the script is pretty good,
yeah,
I feel like my job is pretty much done.
And you can just feel it set. Like if you see a take, you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Was, yeah.
Yeah. It's thrilling, too, because
I bet.
You know, having James Gandolfini and Julia in my living room reading my scenes, I'm kind of looking over my shoulder like, who's the director here?
It's interesting, too, because with those two people in particular, that they were kind of like, you know, anytime Julia has to tone it down, it's like that's the job, you know, for her. Because like, see, she's so natural, like naturally comedically genius.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So anytime she has to almost become more real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is, you know, that's
right.
where you really see, like, what's, you know, what's going on in there, right? So it's a real performance. And then with him having to, like, not...
Want to kill someone.
Yeah.
Not be... Yeah.
That was great. Yeah.
But Julia is a pretty serious person.
Yeah, I've talked to her. Yeah, I can see that. But like, there's no one more naturally comedically gifted than that person.
Yeah. And having her on the set just... cracking me up and cracking everybody up.
I can't even understand it.
Yeah.
Her and like Will Ferrell. It's like they can turn it on and you're like, what is that? And they can turn it off. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Turn it off. Like, be a regular human being. And that's how when I met with Julia to do that, you know, we had lunch. And at first I was like, but she's Elaine. She's Elaine. She, you know, how can I get past that? And it took about 10 seconds. We were talking about our kids. Yeah. And
What's she doing in this next one? Is she going to be hilarious? Is she going to be slapsticky?
Slapsticky? No, I don't think there is slapstick in this one, but plenty of room for her to be a fool. Plenty. In a good way.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Vulnerable, insecure.
Oh, good.
Kind of a mess.
Now, can we just talk about The Last Duel, though, for a minute or two? Because I really love the movie, and I think people should see the movie.
Good. I think people should, too. I wish they would. I think it's on a streaming service.
How do you get that call from those guys?
Yeah.
To be like, you know, hey, we need a lady.
That's pretty much it. I'll be your lady. Can you write girl stuff? I knew Ben a bit. And so I got this email from him, which I did occasionally. But it was an email that just, you know, made my head spin off. I couldn't believe I was, do you want to write something with me and Matt? And I don't know if they said what it was at the time, but I said yes. And then they said what it was, and I went and met with them and said, I don't know how to do this.
Really?
What do I know? I don't know how to speak like this.
Huh.
And they said, neither do we.
Wow.
And they showed me their work, and it was like, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
Whatever they're doing, I can do that. And it became not easy, but I got used to speaking like that and learning how to.
So what was the job primarily her story from her point of view?
Yeah. They wrote the first two. Mm. So I started writing scenes for her.
Uh-huh.
I'd send them the scenes. Some things would make that change in there. It would make their scenes change and eventually it became a collaboration of all of us.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I didn't really touch the battle scenes. But the marriage scenes in all three parts, you know, we all had a part in them. But
right.
I wrote, you know, a lot of Marguerite's story or all of it. And they gave me notes that were really helpful.
Whose idea were the shoes and how the shoes came off or whether she took them off or they fell off? Wasn't that
Ridley? That wasn't in the script.
That was a pretty.
That was good.
Pretty good.
Yeah. He's kind of good.
He is.
Yeah.
And he believes that.
No kidding. No kidding. I think he wanted to kill me while I was on the set.
You did? Why?
A little bit. Well, because, you know, I've never been a writer on the set of someone else directing.
Uh-huh.
It's not like he's not a brilliant director.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Sometimes you see a scene differently.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had to learn how to shut up and, you know, be the invisible writer.
Uh-huh.
Which was fine. It was a great experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't, like, again, I think people should see it. And I thought it was, and so working with them, you were in Ireland? Were you there with them?
Yeah, well, we worked on the script here and then went to France shooting in these castles. And it was just an amazing experience I would never have. And then COVID hit and we all went home.
Yeah.
And then picked it back up in Ireland, which was supposed to be that way.
Yeah.
And I came for some of it.
You like Ireland?
Yeah, it was
great,
beautiful.
Right?
This Dalkey town, and he's very sweet and nice. I think I was the only Jew in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I always want, because I always think about, like, it's my fantasy to live in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And then I wonder, like, how do they feel about Jews? But I think the mayor
they don't
of
know
Ireland.
Anything. Mayor of Ireland is Jewish?
Mayor of Dublin is Jewish,
really?
Isn't he? Or he was, or is there, am I wrong?
I have no idea.
I think he's either gay or Jewish, maybe both.
I remember being in a taxi cab and I was trying to understand the troubles, you know, can you explain the Catholics and the Protestants to me? And
oh, you got to watch Belfast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he wanted me to explain Jewish people. He thought all Jewish people were kosher and all Jewish people wore the hats.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, really naive, lovely man. But it was another world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So don't move there?
Maybe not. Unless there's a Jewish quarter.
I think there's a couple there. Well, it was good talking to you.
You too.
Do you feel good about it?
I do.
Okay, good.
And I breathed.
You did. I didn't hear you gasping.
There we go.
I didn't sense any panic.
No.
And I think we covered a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, and it's a good time to end. My throat hurts.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Nice to talk to you.
You too.
Nicole Hall Center, working on a movie with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and not me. So, and go watch her other movies. They're quite great. No music today. I have no harmonica. I do not want to play air trumpet. Boomer Lives! Monkey, LaFonda. Cat Angels are definitely everywhere. And all kinds of spirits, man. All kinds of spirits.